Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the wonderful Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, we hear from Andrei Vilcek. He's a Russian-born writer and journalist and filmmaker. He's worked a lot in South America and in Japan. Well, in fact, he's been all over. And we speak to him from Beirut, where he lives. He's just come out with a novel called Aurora. And he's got an amazing book called Exposing the Lies of the Empire. Then you're going to be hearing from me, talking about a piece of research that I did tail end of last year, called Secret Societies in Prophecy, part of a conference called Eschatology in the 21st Century. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, I'll give the contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Andrei Vilcek, and I'm a Russian, originally born in Russia, Czech American, whatever, cosmopolitan, global, internationalist, journalist and writer and filmmaker. It's unavoidable that the West and the United States, in particular, in that part of the world, is sponsoring all sorts of opposition movements, works with the most vicious and vile opposition figures, like in Brazil, like in Argentina, and everywhere. You know, there's this new game that is called, corruption scandals. I mean, whatever government is from the left, there is immediately some skeleton in a closet that is being pulled out and highlighted and all this. And, you know, imagine that these countries were living for decades under the right-wing dictatorships sponsored by the West. So, of course, there is always some corruption, or somebody is always somehow a little bit corrupt, or somebody is connected. There cannot be anything clear, 100% clear in any of the societies that went through such a horrible trauma of real moral corruption and destruction and mass murder and rapes that were taking place under the right-wing dictatorships. So every little thing is blown out of proportions and held against the governments that are trying to stand on their feet. And then the media says, and the so-called opposition in these countries says, oh, you see, so everybody is the same. We're the same. This government is the same as the previous one. And I thought, no, I mean, how can you compare, let's say, 20 or 30,000 people who were disappeared and tortured and murdered to, you know, some embezzlement by a minor minister of, I don't know, $500,000. But they compare these things. They put them on the same level. It's the same like, UK media and propaganda is dealing with China. It's the same philosophy. Let's say in Zambia, there is some minor mining disaster, and in the mine that is owned by the Chinese company, and let's say 20 people die because of negligence. And it is terrible, but it's negligence, it's nothing else. But the way it's framed by the UK media, it immediately looks like you put all these tens of millions that disappeared and were murdered by the imperialist empires like UK or France or Belgium, you put these 10 millions on the same level as these 20 people who vanished in a, because of the safety negligence of some Chinese mining company.
I mean, we've had an example here in the news just this week, which is a story about a so-called British jihadi who was released from Guantanamo Bay, apparently awarded a large sum in compensation for wrongfully imprisoning him there. And then we were told yesterday on all of the main channels that he has become a suicide bomber. He's blown himself up. And the only evidence that was actually presented was a picture of a puff of smoke on the other side of a hill. You couldn't even see him anywhere around. And this is all being rolled out through something called SITE, S-I-T-E, the Search for International Terrorist Entities, which is based just around the corner from the NSA up in Bethesda, Maryland. It just seems amazing to me that this kind of event is put out at the top of the bulletins as a piece of news when there's clearly actually no evidence. And not only if there was evidence, it's come apparently from ISIS, and yet ISIS is supposedly a credible source. So I just wonder what, you know, how far is this propaganda going to go before people start saying, well, it's just rubbish, and stop watching?
Yeah, it actually sounds like this British comedy Four Lions, right? I mean, it's just absolutely unbelievable what the propaganda in the West is doing. I wrote several pieces lately, and actually, I find the British propaganda much more violent and much more toxic than the North American.
Well, why is that? North
American one is very primitive. I mean, it's there. Everybody knows it's there, and it's so vulgar that there is there. But British one is very dangerous. I mean, you have an empire which was running for centuries, half of the planet, and basically pacified the entire world, pacified in parentheses, and even convinced the nations that were raped and occupied by it, like India, that actually it was doing quite a good job. I mean, if you talk to Indians, most of them, I speak there very often, and I work everywhere from Kashmir to Kerala, and many of them actually, not all of course, but many of them believe that British administration was quite cool, that it did some good things and bad things, but there is no feeling of outrage about what would happen. Or in Malaysia, also another colony of the UK. So, I mean, it's incredible achievement to rape half of the world, to plunder half of the world, kill tens of millions of people, and then actually leave still being involved somehow through the, you know, counseling and coaching other members of the empire like the United States, but actually to leave with the memories of the colonized and raped and destroyed people that you actually did quite a good job in some fields. It's quite an achievement.
What about, you mentioned that you've been writing this novel of yours. Am I right? It's called Aurora?
Aurora.
Yeah,
Aurora.
So what's the reason for... I mean, because most of your stuff is, I know, articles. You can find Andre Vilcek's articles all over the internet, actually, quite a lot, including your nonfiction books. But what made you decide to write this novel?
Well, I'm actually a novelist who is so outraged about the state of the world that I'm writing a lot of nonfiction books and philosophical books and articles, essays, everything. But I always go back to fiction because to filmmaking. But fiction is to plays, theater plays are very important because there are some things you simply cannot express through nonfiction. And I really think that fiction is still one thing that can mobilize the people because you have to put your heart, you have to put emotions into your writing in order to really outrage people, because people are not outraged anymore by data, by information. So they need something more. Aurora is a relatively short novel. It's about 150 pages, and it is about the cultural imperialism and indoctrination of the countries outside of the Western realm sphere, which are until now bombarded and pacified and derailed from its natural path by the Western culture.
What about some of the characters in the novel then?
Yeah, there are two main characters. One is the head of the huge cultural institute, a European cultural institute, a German-speaking country, which I don't want to name it, but everybody obviously knows it. But I would probably have a lawsuit on my head if I would name the cultural institute of that German-speaking country. And the head of... this institute is basically an agent. He's an intelligence agent, but he's also there in the huge Asian country, which again is most likely Indonesia, but I don't name, I don't say the name of it. But he's basically, you know, through grants and funding, he's helping to pacify and indoctrinate young artists. But they also do much more horrible things. I mean, they still kidnap, they still torture, they still rape, as was done before. So I'm actually putting the culture the Western culture and European culture in particular, and the crimes against humanity together. And it's a very strange, it's a conceptually very complex book, because there is a Mozart who appears, he's very angry about the whole thing, because they also kind of raped him in Old Vienna, and they never let him create. And he's sitting in some pub in a Chilean port city of Valparaiso together with Bertolt Brecht. And they are telling the story exactly of this German cultural attaché in Indonesia. And Aurora, who is a girl, who is a very talented Indonesian painter who managed to escape Indonesia in the past and married a very famous communist progressive painter from Venezuela, with whom she, with her husband, she comes back, and there she confronts the this German cultural attaché. So it's actually a dialogue in an old former capital of that country between these two people. I mean, and it's a dialogue between the left, between actually Latin American left, because this girl, although she's Indonesian, she adopted the ideas of Latin American revolution, and between this cultural establishment of Europe. It's very powerful. It's very humorous, actually, especially in Europe. Culture is being glorified and put on the pedestal. But if you look closely what it really is, it's just centuries very often of absolute prostitution in classical music, in painting. I mean, you go to Louvre, you go to National Gallery, and it's outrageous what you see. It's basically, you know, painters and musicians serving the cardinals and aristocracy and kings and everyone just in exchange for some kind of recognition and comfortable life. There is absolutely no, you know, even you go to Louvre, right? I mean, you're in the second after UK, biggest country, biggest colonizing empire. Empire that was destroying countries and nations all over the world. And you don't see almost any rebellion of the artists against the colonialism. There is nothing about the suffering of people all over the world. So the culture, the European art and culture, is tremendously cowardly historically, and I'm addressing this issue as well. You cannot even compare it to like what is happening now in China or in Latin America. They criticize China for not being free. You go to 798, this huge city of art galleries in Beijing. They criticize everything from environment to capitalism to the Chinese socialism to everything. I mean, everything is political, and art participates in all this. You go in Paris, you see like a poodles on the, you know, you see like a silver poodles on the bronze leash, and you see half-naked Japanese women and photographs exhibited in galleries. There is nothing, there is almost nothing daring, nothing provocative, nothing is, you know, reality is not reflected in the Western art.
You're talking here in Bristol, and Bristol was a great centre of the slave trade for about 200 years. Amazing that there is no real cultural institute here in Bristol which talks about that. I mean, we had the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, which had a pretty excellent exhibition, I think it would be around about 2008, on the slave trade, which was a warts and all, look at it all. And what happened? Well, the funding got pulled and the museum closed.
Yeah, but this is actually, and this is, this we are talking about, there is nothing anymore internationalist in the European art, but the art is so cowardly in Europe that it doesn't even reflect, it doesn't even deal with the problems that their own people are having. I mean, look, after what happened in the UK with Brexit, after what you see all over the all over Europe, where the right-wing governments are being elected, people are depressed. You just see them being depressed in Paris, in Germany, in Czech Republic. You know, they're really lost. They don't know what to do. And this is exactly the time when the artists should be reacting. I mean, there should be films. There is nothing even about, you know, if you look at the Thatcher's era. I mean, there was a great cinema. There was a great British New Wave. There were films like Letter to Brezhnev, High Hopes, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. You cannot buy these films even online. I mean, you can probably, but it's very difficult. I was searching for them the other day, and even these films are forgotten. And it's like a good old labor, you know, speaking in that period of time. And it's not so long, it's not such a long time ago. And all this is gone in continental Europe. It's gone in UK. I just see art and as a very toothless and embarrassing kind of thing.
So are you suggesting we need some kind of cultural revolution?
Well, of course. And also, they should go and learn something, for heaven's sake, instead of putting their defunct art and culture on the pedestal. They should go to China. They should go to Latin America. They should go even to South Africa and learn something, because there is still tremendous creativity in all these parts of the world, and people are alive. You know, they are fighting for something. They're not always succeeding. It's sometimes, two steps forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. But they are fighting. You go to South Africa, there really is tremendous fight for improving the country. You go to China, it's a enormous fight in what direction the country will go. Not to speak about Latin America. I mean, every little town in South America, in places like Ecuador or Venezuela, the ideas are being ventilated. The ideas are being discussed. There are clashes. People demonstrate against each other. People fight on the stage. You can have a fist fight even, during the art openings. I once encountered it in Maracaibo, in the second city in Venezuela. And that's correct. That's how it should be. I mean, people are passionate about their changing the society. But in Europe, it's totally lobotomized.
Well,
it's,
there seems to be very little passion in BBC drama, that's for sure. And I think that's what you're aiming at. Anyway, you also penned an article recently on Counterpunch, The West is Finished. What did you mean, The West is Finished? I mean, are you talking in a cultural sense or what?
In cultural sense, but also it's quite complex. It's a philosophical article, so listeners should read it. It's very difficult to actually summarize it. But what I'm saying is that there was this entire obsession with science and knowledge and facts and all this actually created pseudo-understanding of science, pseudo-perceptions of reality and all that. And in the meantime, people lost the ability to feel, to emotionally, live in these countries. And they cannot, that's one of the reasons why they cannot create, and that's why they cannot anymore rebel. You know, they cannot commit to anything. They make these premarital agreements. They meet each other. They before they even decide to be together, they kick each other like test drive each other like a car to see if they fit or anything. There is nothing. There is no daring in relationships. There is no daring in. But the same thing is with revolution or with any change. I mean, you have to commit yourself. You really have to single-mindedly sometimes bulldozer things and believe in things, but they cannot believe anymore in anything. You know, everything is being questioned, everything is being rationalized. At the end, everybody ends up on the couch shouting at television sets, and nobody wants to be labeled. Nobody wants to put, if you are a Marxist, if you are a communist, you are ashamed almost to put labels on your head, because God forbid, you know, people can think you are a total moron or you are too naive or, you know, it's just totally outdated. So everybody is very cool, but at the end, everything is empty and nothing is almost nobody is committed to anything. In anything, but it's a very complex essay I wrote. It's quite long. It's like
anyway. I mean, I'll put a link to that article on our show page at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Also, because you're Russian particularly, I'd just like to get your take on Putin and the United Russia Party and how you think they're doing, because he does seem to have a tremendous amount of support if you compare him to a lot of the Western leaders whose support is very fragile, like Theresa May, for example. Whether you think that this is allowing a kind of a bit more of a cultural freedom and the Renaissance over in Russia?
Yeah, well, Tony, first of all, when I say that I'm Russian, honestly speaking, I mean, it's kind of my rebellion. I used to, if you would ask me 5 years ago, I would hesitate. I would say, yeah, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen. I was educated in New York. I was born in Russia. I grew up in Czech Republic. I have Chinese blood in me and all this. I wouldn't know what to answer. And now with this combat and this propaganda against Russia, I just say I'm Russian. It's also, in a way, my provocation. It's my way of showing the finger to the empire, you know, and especially here, like in the Middle East, it's great. I go to the barber and say, where are you from? I say, I'm Russian. They come and they give me a hug and they almost cry and say, thank you. You know, I mean, okay, great. But about Putin, it's complicated. Look, I worked in Russia several times recently. I was in Moscow a few months ago, and I was in the Far East, and that was actually much more interesting than Moscow. I was in Vladivostok, Khabarovsk, and even in Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky, all the way in Kamchatka. One thing that is surprising is that people really do support the government, and I would say, like in the Far East at least, I would say maybe more than 80% do, and very sincerely. And it's interesting why. You ask them why, and they would tell you two things. First of all, of course, after this horror of Yeltsin and nitwit Gorbachev period, when country totally collapsed, and you had scientists selling their libraries in a bitter cold in underpasses of Novosibirsk and Moscow, you know, and old people didn't get paid, they didn't get their retirement plan and pensions. It was just total horror. So things, of course, improved. You go to every regional capital, it is a nice airport, it is a public hospitals, public schools, salaries are paid and all that. So this improved, but this is not really the only reason why they support Putin. And I would say this is very similar to China. And this is what the West doesn't realize. If you talk to Chinese or if you talk to Russians and you ask them about the situation, the global situation now, and this horrible attacks that both countries are facing, I think both nations had enough. And they will tell you, look, we are sending our messages to the government. Don't let the West get away with this anymore. You know, both countries were attacked, destroyed horribly. China by Brits and French and others by Americans, Russia, Soviet Union, or Russia, of course, on many occasions. And people had enough. They do understand the vileness and toxic impact of the Western imperialism, and that they are again pushing to something absolutely horrific. And these two governments, because China has a so-called heavenly mandate, right? I mean, no matter what government is in power, it's running on the borrowed time. I mean, if the nation doesn't want this government to be in power, it will kick it out. And that was for thousands of years, and it didn't change. I mean, the Communist Party of China is afraid of its own people, and that's nice, because when people wanted Deng Xiaoping to make capitalist reforms, Deng Xiaoping did it. And now when President Xi wants to go back to socialism, he wants to go back to socialism because of the pressure that comes from the Chinese voters. So they both listen, and Putin too. They know that Russian people or Chinese people don't want this to be allowed anymore to continue. This absolute unbridled and open aggression that is coming from the West for centuries, but which again now is is accelerating and which can totally destroy the world. So this is what you hear in the Far East of Russia too. They will tell you, look, there are some things we disagree with President Putin, but he helped our nation to rise from our knees. We are standing again. We are strong. We will never allow this the horrors that we went through on so many occasions in history to repeat themselves. So it's that's what the main reason is. Socially, things improved. I think the country is governed in a decent way, not really in the perfect way. Nothing is perfect, and I don't know really how to label it, because you know, I'm from the left. I wish I could call Russia a socialist country. I don't know whether it is. I mean, for me, always communism was a perpetual fight against Western imperialism. Socialist in economically, maybe not. It's a mixed economy. Is it socialist in a social sphere? Well, it's maybe social democratic, and hopefully it's moving into the left. But definitely, its foreign policy is, now they adopted the foreign policy of the Soviet Union in a good way, I think.
Okay, now look, you mentioned there the Russia being on its knees in the early 1990s. One of the things that's just been going around as a, I don't know if it's a rumor, there certainly is some evidence for it, that because the Red Army hadn't been paid, that some of the Russian nuclear weapons were actually for sale on the black market. Now, that doesn't sound unfeasible. I wonder if you have any lines into that particular one, because it doesn't sound impossible, and yet it would be quite dangerous if, you know, for several years in the early 90s, that this kind of stuff was peddled. I mean, these soldiers hadn't been paid for months, years, and they were looking for a bit of cash just to feed their families.
Well, yes, it was happening, and I know about it because I was working in a places like Tomsk and Novosibirsk at the time. And it wasn't only the army. I mean, you had entire institutes and entire plants in Siberia and elsewhere that were producing, you know, nuclear materials, not weapons. I mean, forget about weapons. You don't need weapons, really. They were producing nuclear materials, and they were there very badly protected. And somebody would be selling them. It was just the country was in total disarray. It was totally collapsing, and it was they were just there, and the security was horrible, and just anybody could come and take them, basically. It was on that level, and of course corruption was huge. That was a period when there was this deal between Al Gore and Chernomyrdin, and they actually even led the Americans to build some deterrence systems, walls and perimeters in these plants. That's how bad things were.
Now, also, we've seen recently, end of last year, John Pilger's latest film, The Coming War on China. I wonder if you've seen it. And
I saw the film. John sent me the link, yes.
So, I mean, I wonder what you make of that, because it does seem to put together a pretty strong case that the US is relentlessly, bit by bit, preparing. I mean, they're surrounding China in a similar way to they've done with Iran, for example, and Russia, and simply preparing for war. I mean, there's some amazing scenes in it where you've got US forces personnel living cheek by jowl with extreme poverty of the islanders in the Indian Ocean, etc. So, I mean, this is our South China Sea. So, you know, you've got a potential conflict which is brewing, particularly with Trump starting to make some very insulting noises about China.
Look, I mean, I agree with John fully about that, and I'm writing about it a lot lately. But we disagree, of course, on some things that he made in this film, particularly about Chinese capitalism and all that. I still consider China a socialist country, and I have many reasons for believing that it is, and or knowing that it is. But I think John adopted a little bit stereotypical Western approach about China. It is not a capitalist country. It's a very successful socialist country, Chinese way. About Marshall Islands, I actually helped John to get some contacts there, because I wrote a whole book called Oceania, and I was working there. I know all about Marshall Islands and Iwai and the Kwajalein Atoll. It's a horrific stuff. It's where the U.S. is shooting its ballistic missiles from California and performing tests, and the missiles are falling to the most beautiful and the biggest atoll in the Pacific Ocean. Anyway, but it is very dangerous. I work in this field a lot, because I work with China Academy of Social Sciences. I go to China very often, but I also work a lot in Philippines and in Vietnam. So I see how the West is provoking Asian countries against China. And look, I have testimonies even of Philippine academics, top intellectuals who just say, look, I mean, Philippines has no claim, no historic claim on the disputed areas in the South China Sea. And it, it's actually the government was pushed to play this game and to provoke China. So notice now when President Duterte is in power, how violent and toxic hate propaganda against him was launched in both Europe and the United States, all about the killings of in this drug war and all this. It's all about China because Duterte refused to play this game. He threatened to kick out Americans. He made a peace with, he's making peace with China very quickly, and he called China the kindest nation on earth. And he met Putin, his hero. So I mean, notice this, and it goes like absolute avalanche and explosion of anti-Duterte propaganda, and of course funding of NGOs in Philippines that are trying to oust him. Exactly the same scenario that you have in Latin America, because actually this the country is and was the most important part of anti-Chinese coalition, but it is also a country which lost 1 million people during the U.S. massacres at the beginning of the 20th century. So it's a very important country.
I wonder if you could just run us through titles of some of your books and your latest novel. Just remind us of that.
Okay, so the book is called Aurora, and that's the novel that we mentioned. And my huge and quite well, I don't want to say best-selling, but well-selling nonfiction book of 840 pages is called Exposing Lies of the Empire. And Exposing Lies of the Empire is a medley of mosaic of my reports and essays that I wrote all over the world, where I try to detect how the Western Empire is destroying everything that is standing on its way, and also how the people are resisting. And it is non-fiction, but it has some elements of fiction, because not fiction, but I'm using dialogues, I'm using humor, vulgarities, everything, because I believe that even in non-fiction and even in philosophy, we have to put some feelings into the writing, so people don't die from boredom when they just read naked facts.
Andrei Vilcek, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Donny, pleasure, and we'll speak soon again.
Yep.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Back in December 2016, I was asked by something called Global Vision 2000 to do a talk in a North London, well, it actually was originally a synagogue, now it's a mosque, a Shia mosque, and this talk was really about something called eschatology. Now, I've no proof, but I think we're going to be thinking and talking more about eschatology in the years to come, because it's the end of the world. That's what it is, a study of the end of the world. Now, one of the most fascinating things, I think, is to look at various different faiths, particularly the Judeo-Christian faiths, in Middle East origin faiths. So that's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and to compare what do each one say about the end of the world. Anyway, I'm no expert in any of them, but I do have a Bible, and so I thought I'd go through some of the places, for example, in the Bible, where you can find things about the end of the world. It's certainly something that, if there is a loving God out there, that he would probably make sure that people recognised it when the end of the world was coming. So anyway, this is a sort of brief précis of my talk, which you can find online, and it's on YouTube, and it's called Eschatology in the 21st Century, Biblical Icons and Mainstream Media by me, Tony Gosling. So one of the most important things is, whereabouts do we go into the Bible to find these? And First is Daniel 9. That's in the Old Testament, towards the end of the Old Testament, the book of Daniel. Quite obviously, this is going to be much more of interest to Jewish people, because Daniel is part of the Jewish tradition. And also worth mentioning that the Protestants took a large chunk of the book of Daniel out of the Bible. The end of Daniel is gone in the Protestant Bibles, whereas you can actually find it in the Catholic Bibles and, of course, in the Orthodox Bibles. I'm not sure if there are Orthodox Bibles in English, but anyhow, so that's Daniel 9. Then also Matthew 24, which is Jesus in the book of Matthew talking about the end of the world, called the Olivet Discourse on the Mount of Olives. And then Revelation 4-22. Now, this is the key bit, really, because the book of Revelation is a fascinating document. I mean, some will say it's just like Nostradamus, others that it's an integral part of the completion of God's plan in the Bible, seen in the New Testament. Also, that over the years, many of the discussions about which books should be in the biblical canon, because some have been taken out over the centuries, others added, etc. There were big attempts to get rid of Revelation from the Bible, so it's in a way a little bit of a miracle that it's all still there. So anyway, between chapter 4 and chapter 22 in Revelation is where you'll find most of the material about the end of the world. In there it talks about seven seals. And then it talks about the first four seals, which are the four horsemen of the apocalypse, white, red, black and pale horses. You could probably suggest, you know, difficult to know what the white horse is at the beginning, but the red horse is most definitely the outbreak of a massive war. The black horse, well, that's, if you have a look at that, you'll see it's almost certainly to do with an enormous great economic crash. It talks about it costing vast amounts of money for just a little bit of bread and that sort of thing. And then the pale horse, which is all to do with famine and pestilence, so disease ravaging the planet. So that's the seven seals. Then you get, they're actually in three, so you get seven seals, seven trumpets and seven bowls in Revelation, and in that order. So that's between Revelation 4 and 22. Then you have, as part of the research for this, I looked at an old video from a chap called Barry Smith. Now, Barry's a New Zealand preacher, and his talks were quite interesting, I felt. What is this number 666? Well, that's in the book of Revelation, the mark of the beast, supposedly. The number of the beast is 666. And Barry points out, and of course it could be pure coincidence, that the US government is made up of 666 officials. That is 435 representatives, 100 senators, 90 district court judges, 13 appeal court judges, 9 Supreme Court justices, 4 territorial justices, 14 members of the cabinet and one president, which, add them all up together, makes 666 members of the US government. So the end of the age, the tribulation it's called, also known as the end times. Looking at our news in the modern world, what could this all be about? Well, quite clearly it's focus on Jerusalem, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque is on the current site of the temple, the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. So there are all sorts of speculation and also talk of demolishing the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Now, this, of course, would cause a lot of consternation amongst Muslims because up until now, this temple site has been shared between Jews and Muslims. And there is an organization in Israel called the Third Temple Institute, which is actually planning to rebuild the temple. The Jewish temple, of course, there won't be any room for the Al-Aqsa Mosque if and when they succeed in doing that. We also have something in Revelation called the Image of the Beast. That's also known as the Abomination of Desolation. Now, what is that? I mean, it sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? Abomination of Desolation. But apparently it's some kind of animated godlike figure. And no one will really, I suppose, know what that is. But anyway, certainly something to watch out for if it pops up in the future. The mark of the beast, 666, that now that is quite clear in Revelation. That would be used for buying and selling, the mark of the beast. What is it? Well, it seems pretty clear that this is some kind of microchip, that is to say an RFID chip, very much like the ones we can see on our debit cards and credit cards. And if you haven't noticed, there's less and less use of cash. The Finns and other people have been really pushing, in India, in fact, more recently, to get rid of cash completely. Now, why is that significant? Well, it's because tradition tells you and history tells us that money is much more important and useful if it has actually some kind of intrinsic value, whether that be gold, silver, copper, or anything. And what the cashless society is doing is it's taking away any intrinsic value from money and it's turning it into just a little chitty on a computer screen somewhere. And that isn't a good thing. It's actually the system which was used in ancient Egypt, of kind of credits for every individual in Egypt had a number of credits. And this is a similar kind of thing. So the cash is being gotten rid of without anyone really being asked. It actually shows us that there is actually a fantastic amount of power amongst the banks, the bankers, to decide these things. And no one's really being asked. That someone somewhere has decided we're going to get rid of cash. So I would suggest what you do is you have a look on your credit card and your debit card to see if there's a little, I don't know how you would describe it really. It looks like kind of a little radio waves sign, three little waves coming out from a dot. And that shows that you have a contactless card. What you can do with many banks is you can choose to have a non-contactless card. The reason for that is pretty obvious, is that you don't want people, as Marks and Spencers were shown to have done a few years ago, as you walk past a checkout, suddenly the money is gone from your card and it's in the company whose checkout you've just walked past. Even evidence that it could take money from your card whilst you're walking along the street outside Marks and Spencers. So this is a bit worrying to think that without actually physically getting near to a terminal, you can have money debited from your account. Why would anyone want to do that? It's completely insecure. So there is obviously, they would say it's very that they've got checks and balances, but it's, I think, very dangerous to have that sort of card. So you can, with many banks, you can say, oh, actually, I just want a chip and PIN card without the contactless ability. And you can always tell by looking on the card, debit or credit, to see if it's got the little waves, which signify a contactless payment card. But why am I saying all this? Well, it's because the mark of the beast is something which would be used for buying and selling. The Bible's quite clear about that. And that means whether you won't be able to buy or sell without having the mark of the beast. And it says in the right hand or in the forehead. So what it seems to be hinting at there is that in the future we will have two classes of people. We will have a kind of hand chip class, so that would be a microchip in your hand, say for example in the little fleshy bit between your thumb and your forefinger, and there will be an elite who have some kind of chip in their forehead. Well, I mean, this is feasible, I suppose, but it does look as if we are heading towards a society of elite super rich, and the rest of us don't have any kind of basic rights, like rights of food, water, somewhere to eat, something to eat, somewhere to live, that kind of thing. And so I think the mark of the beast is one of the biggest correlations between what the Bible's saying and the slow pursuit of the cashless society, getting rid of the basic. I mean, for example, you don't even have to sign now, do you, to pay for things? It's just a chip and PIN, and now contactless. So also secret societies were worth looking at. Those I discovered recently from Jacob Zaki, this Islamic historian, that the late 1700s, the Illuminati in Europe appeared at around about the same time as the triads over in China, with the Manchu dynasty. There was a whole load of battles going on in China about who was going to control the country in the future, which dynasty was going to take over. So that's interesting, I think, that around about the same decade, the late 1700s, that the triads popped up in China and the Illuminati popped up in Europe, having their Wilhelmsbad conference, which brought all European Freemasonry under the control of this group called the Illuminati at Wilhelmsbad. So what about these secret societies? Well, in ancient Egypt, they had their pyramids. You can see the pyramid on the back of the dollar. So there does seem to be an affinity with the ancient Egyptians, which, of course, who were the sworn enemies of the Jews back in those days when the Jews were under captivity and Moses managed to help set his people free. And then you've got these Babylonian mystery religions from the Babylonian captivity, the Kabbalah. And worth noting that there are these two Talmuds in Judaism. One is the Babylonian Talmud and the other is the Jerusalem Talmud. So they developed this school of Judaism in Babylon in captivity, which was acceptable to the Babylonians, and a completely separate tradition in Judaism, which was maintaining the original Jerusalem traditions in Judaism. There's also controlling all governments. Well, that's the plan of the Illuminati, apparently, all religions and governments. So the idea being really to have a long-term plan to infiltrate all religions and all political parties. It was a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments in Europe. And at the time, it was an absolute sensation, written by John Robison, who was a close friend of James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine. So, of course, nowadays we've got religious cults like the Moonies, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, and you've also got the Mafia and the Yakuza. So there's lots of these secret societies around there, and I suppose you'd say a minor secret society are the cults like Freemasonry and, as I said, the Mafia and Jehovah's Witnesses. There's lots of them out there. One of the most fascinating books is Tim Cohen's, I think. It's called The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. He believes the Order of the Garter will be the place where the Antichrist comes from. He says it's the apex of world witchcraft. So whether that's true or not, I do not know. But certainly there are 26 members of the Order of the Garter. It's been the protectors of the British Crown for centuries. It's the oldest chivalric order in the world, and of course 26 is 2 times 13, so that may just be 2 covens of 13 witches. At least that's what Tim Cohen is saying in his book, is the idea he's putting forward. Also, let's also take a look at church history right from the start. So you've got the flood, 2350 BC. You can pretty much, you know, most people who've looked at trying to pin the flood down in some point in history, say, just looking at the way that the sediment is in the land, pin it down to around about that time. And also that's pretty much when the Bible says it. The Old Testament says it was, Book of Genesis. And then you've got in 1491 BC, Moses and the Exodus, I mentioned just now, and the Ten Commandments, 1491 BC. Then 1000 BC, the building of Solomon's temple to begin with. Interesting that the Masons revere Solomon, and that actually it was a bit of a disaster, the temple. And Solomon's reign was a disaster because he was fraternizing with all sorts of attractive ladies, and he was steering the Jewish people away from God. He started off as a very good king, but then he fell, and the Masons revere him. Then you've got 30 AD, you've got Jesus' baptism, Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection in 33 AD, which is amazing to think that his ministry only lasted for 3 years, roughly. Then in 313, Constantine converted. So that is the Roman Emperor. Up until 313, the Roman Empire had been persecuting Christians really seriously. Like, anyone who was a Christian would be arrested, burnt at the stake, this sort of thing. And in fact, the roads into Rome were all lined by, at night time, with burning Christians on great big poles. So that's all changed when Constantine, the emperor, converted to so-called to Christianity and decided that he couldn't beat Christianity as an underground movement because it was growing and growing. And so he decided to have a kind of Roman church, which would control Christianity and would allow people to become Christians. Then 630 AD, the Quran was first written. Then 1054 was the Great Schism. And this is when the Orthodox Church and the Roman Church split off from each other. So that was when the Pope in Constantinople excommunicated the Pope in Rome, and the Pope in Rome excommunicated the Pope in Constantinople. So that's where you got the 1054, you've got the original splitting of the original church. Now, of course, a lot of Roman Catholics say, oh, well, our church is the original successor. Well, actually, no, the Orthodox Church is, which is mostly in Greece, Russia, Eastern Europe, and obviously Turkey too. So that's quite, I mean, you know, an interesting date in history, 1054, the Great Schism. And then you got another schism, didn't you, with the Protestants separating out from the Catholics. 1517, that's where Luther began the Reformation. Of course, we had Calvin and other people involved in all that, and taking some of these books away from the Bible. I mentioned Daniel, but there are others. And then also saying, well, we don't believe in the Pope, but it seems it's all right to be a Freemason if you're in the Protestant Church, but it wasn't if you're a Catholic. So, you know, they were splitting off, but they were doing things very differently to the original. I mean, we're now talking about three churches away from the original with the Protestants. Then you've got in 1640 the English Civil War and the emergence of non-conformist people like the Baptists, the Quakers, and all sorts of different groups who basically were fed up with the established church, the Church of England, telling them everything. I mean, what the Quakers would do, for example, is stand up in the middle of a church service in the Civil War and say, well, I don't agree with you. You know, I think I've got a different interpretation. And so there was a non-conformist chapel faith which sprung up in England as part of the English Civil War, which is still around, largely still around today. So let's just go through, again, a bit of a timeline. I mentioned the Wilhelmsbad Conference, where the Congress established the Illuminati as the governing body of Freemasonry. That was in 1782. Then in 1933, we had the pagan Nazi Party, which came to power. Its aim was to wipe out Europe's rabbinic tradition. And in 1947, the State of Israel was established, the Crusaders' own Holy Land. Actually, potentially, this is just there to discredit Judaism, is it? I mean, the biblical-based faith seems to be under a destruction program, and these various events are part of that. The Wilhelmsbad Conference in 1782, the Nazi Party in 1933, the State of Israel in 1947. I mean, it's quite feasible that that's exactly what they're trying to do, is just discredit these faiths. So in the 1960s and 70s, we had a lot of freedom of the arts, but UK laws against abortion and fornication were repealed. So the legal structure in England was and Britain was moving away from a biblical-based set of values. In 2001, the 9/11 attacks were carried out by US-Israeli secret services. Well, I say that because I would urge you to have a look at an article, 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World, on the Wikispooks website, which links the 9/11 attacks to a whole bunch of dual US-Israeli citizens who were working in the United States at the time. Of course, the object of all this was to allow the US to just kind of march around the world wherever it wanted, or we're finding terrorists here and terrorists there, with nobody seeming to notice, like ISIS, that much of the terrorism is actually funded by their allies, and particularly Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. The money's coming through UBS Bank and Credit Suisse in Switzerland, which is notorious for its secret banking. So no one knows where the money's coming from because the Swiss are keeping it quiet. And also the rise of Islamophobia. I mean, this is very much like, isn't it, the attack on the Jews by Hitler. And we had in 2014 and 2016... David Cameron and Theresa May claiming to be Christians, and yet the policies that they're bringing out are anti-Christian. So in other words, they're hurting the poor, they're giving massive tax breaks to big corporations and the rich. So that isn't Christian, is it? And then you've got in 2016, the chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, says he fully supports the Israeli state. Again, of course, that discredits Judaism by him saying that, because the Israeli state is not actually upholding biblical laws like Moses' laws at all. Anyway, that's a bit of a tour around my talk, and you can see the full version, which is on YouTube. It's called Biblical Icons and Mainstream Media: Eschatology in the 21st Century. And if you haven't heard the word eschatology before, it means study of the end of the world, and it's well worth having a look at. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. That's Andre Vilcek and me talking about eschatology in the 21st century, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Get hold of us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897, online at prsc.org.uk. Or you can go to the volunteering website. Says Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. During March, Dialect has four programmes, and all of them will be being guest produced by David Lowe. You may remember several years ago, the BBC sacked David Lowe for using the N-word in a song, but the trouble is he plays all the songs from the 1940s, and that was just normal in those days. Anyway, it was a big controversy about it, but David has agreed to do four programmes for us during March, so you can catch those all every week during March at noon every Tuesday. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So till the same time next week, goodbye for now. Sometimes